Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast. I'm Sarah Bankson, Deputy Director of RTP. Today, we're excited to host two experts discussing the use of outside counsel by attorneys general. Luke Wake, attorney at Pacific Legal Foundation and chair of RTP's State and Local Working Group, and Kaitin Birud, attorney at Cozen O'Connor and formerly Deputy General Counsel of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and a senior executive in the Nevada AG's office. Thank you both for being here with us today. Our listeners can read the full bios for our speakers at regproject.org. With that, I will pass it over to you, Luke.
Thank you so much, Sarah. So, yes, as mentioned, we are both involved in the RTP State Local Regulation Working Group, and our goal in this project is to shine a light on regulatory issues that are causing problems for society for which there are no benefits or inordinate burdens to the benefits. And in that vein, we've done a bunch of white papers and podcasts talking about a number of different issues, and we're always interested in exploring issues that maybe are underappreciated. And so in that vein, we wanted to talk about not necessarily regulation per se, but maybe the way in which regulation is enforced. And with that in mind, I wanted to have a conversation here about this practice, and Kaitin can explain more what we're talking about here, but the practice of essentially farming out, one could say, bringing in the mercenaries of private counsel on behalf of the state or perhaps the city to enforce regulatory regimes of various matters. And I suppose this could be done in other contexts, but I'm specifically wrap my head around the regulatory issues here. So, would you mind just giving us an overview of the phenomena we're talking about and how common it is?
Yeah. So, I guess I'd start with playing off something you said earlier. I wouldn't say this the use. So, I think at a broad level, we're going to talk about the use of outside counsel, law firms by attorneys generals, and then tangentially by state or city and county subdivisions as well. But I would say this isn't one of those places where there is no benefit or the benefit necessarily out or the benefit is necessarily outweighed by the burden. I think it's like a lot of things where the practice unchecked, done not well, not done without the appropriate amount of transparency can be detrimental, and the cost can outweigh the benefits. And that's, I think, what we're going to talk about a little bit here. But so functionally, it's my belief as somebody who's practiced in this space for about the last 10 years, working 4 years in an AG's office and now at a law firm that deals in this space, deals with state attorneys general, deals with the plaintiff's counsel that represent them, is that the practice of state attorneys generals hiring outside counsel, it's widespread, it's entrenched, it's become a common solution for addressing complex legal challenges and other challenges. I can't tell you exactly the extent of it, though, which I think is one of the issues, is that there's a lack of transparency. And so there's challenges in measuring how often this happens. So for one, there's a lack of centralized data. And maybe we shouldn't have a centralized data, but there's no comprehensive national database tracking every instance of government entities hiring outside counsel. And one of the reasons for that is that both at the state and local level, the laws regarding the amount of transparency required both before hiring and after hiring is very different. And so different jurisdictions have varying laws and regulations governing the hiring of outside counsel, one, influencing how and when they can engage private firms, but two, on the reporting of it. And so that's kind of talking a little bit about, how often does it happen now? My gut is that it happens quite a bit. It particularly happens in some of the more high profile cases, opioids, going after the big tech companies, things where there's a lot of money involved. it wasn't as common 30 or 40 years ago. The first time you really saw it rise to prominence was during the tobacco litigation during the 1990s. And there were a lot of outside law firms that represented states and were able to secure large settlements for themselves and for the states. And I think that that started a trend where outside counsel saw that, hey, representing states can be very lucrative. So let's start building practices around this. Let's start pitching state attorneys general so we can do some of this work. And then starting probably more in the 2000s and picking up more and more since then, we've seen that proliferate.
Well, it seems that, I mean, I've encountered this a lot in our practice at Pacific Legal Foundation, where we're suing, for example, municipalities over regulatory takings issues. And almost, you know, very commonly anyways, they bring in outside counsel, but presumably because they just don't have expertise on that issue per se. And so I can see sort of a genuine need on, in some instances to farm out outside counsel where maybe, you know, you've got a city attorney in particular. It's a little different dynamic when you have an entire attorney general's office with presumably a lot more manpower and resources. But one would think that there are some legitimate uses here. And so, as you know, figuring out the right balance is I think more what we're talking about here. One question I would ask maybe to help, you know, frame this a little bit, because you're talking about this as you know, potentially problematic. And I want to help, you know, wrap my mind around this and help others listening here. You know, why is this maybe controversial or subject that we're talking about at all? Because, for example, in the private context, anyways, you know, general counsel has all sorts of issues that they're dealing with in the private company, and they're not going to handle all of those issues. They're going to bring in outside counsel. Why is this different, or to what extent is it different from that scenario?
Yeah. And so I think at some point we should talk about the benefits of why this makes sense, because I think in a lot of contexts, it can make sense for state attorney generals to hire legal counsel. But I think before we do that, it's important to talk about what the considerations are that we should be taking into account, why this can be problematic. And I think at the beginning, there can be ethical and oversight concerns, right? And so there's not always an alignment with the public interest between the goals of the outside counsel and what traditionally the role of the state attorney general has been, which is representing, you know, the interests of the people, right? And so at a base level, if you hire outside counsel, and let's say you're using a contingency fee agreement, if the incentive is, whether or not they're following that incentive entirely, is that they want to maximize the financial recovery that they're going to get, because they're getting a percentage of that ultimate recovery. Whereas the state attorney general himself or herself, whoever it is, wouldn't get a cut of that litigation. So they might be prioritizing something else. So, for example, let's say that a company was charging usurious interest rates on loans, and your state had a law against charging those usurious interest rates. A state attorney general without a financial incentive might be looking for immediate remedial action. So they might go to that lender and say, hey, there is a law saying you can't charge over X percent. Please stop doing so right now. And if you stop doing so right now, we'll hit you with, you know, X dollar fine. Are you willing to pay that? The issue is resolved. If you have a plaintiff's counsel who's an outside law firm who has an incentive to make as much money as they can, they wouldn't necessarily even want to come and say, hey, stop this practice now. There's actually an incentive for them to not even say, stop the practice now. It's just to file suit. And at the end of it, ask for a large recovery and take some portion of that.
And my sense is that, I mean, and I've dealt with, you know, the Department of Justice litigates cases entirely differently than state attorney general's offices, and I'm sure that varies by state as well. And then, you know, private counsel is my sense is, and I'm interested in your views, and I'm not sure if there's a way to, you know, show this empirically, but that there's just private counsel is going to litigate cases differently. It's maybe more of a scorched earth mentality. Is that part of the concern here as well?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different things, right? So I talked about one thing that if you have plaintiff's attorneys on the outside representing you, they have a financial incentive if there's a contingency. Apart from that, too, let's say you hire them on an hourly basis. One that you talked about, the scorched earth litigation, if you're paying an attorney by the hour, they similarly don't have an incentive to resolve the matter early. They have an incentive to bill as many hours as they can, inflict as much pain as they can, and make as much money as they can doing that. But that's not only in the case of hourly fee arrangements. You could have a contingency fee arrangement where, again, the outside counsel is prioritizing putting as much pain as they can on the defendant company to ultimately ratchet up the amount of the settlement that they're willing to pay. So I think no matter what arrangement you have, there can be that incentive for a private law firm to use scorched earth tactics.
Now, you mentioned the OIBO litigation as an example of that, of this is coming up. And you want to flesh that out a little bit, or maybe provide some other sort of concrete examples of where maybe you think there was, you've noted lack of oversight as maybe being an issue. And we can talk more about that, because I tend to think that the sort of concerns we're talking about here probably can be addressed by sort of better oversight, because we're ultimately talking about when you bring in counsel, it's supposed to be an agency relationship, and they're supposed to be serving their client's interests. So if they're going out, I guess it depends on a number of things here. But can you give some concrete examples of where maybe you think things have gotten a little out of hand in this context?
So are you asking for the types of cases where outside counsel is used, or are you asking about particular tactics, or I guess I'm trying to make sure I understand.
Yeah, well, maybe like case studies is maybe, and you mentioned in our conversation and then sort of the outline that you had prepared, and then a number of examples where this had come up.
Yeah, so I was going to say, I don't want to talk about a specific case, because I kind of want to stay away from that from the purpose of what we're doing here. But at a high level, I'll go through kind of the examples where you see that this is more prevalent. And so I think particularly environmental litigation, so where you have pollution or environmental damages, governments often will sue corporations that they think are responsible for significant economic harm. So that's oil spills, toxic waste dumping, and at least one of the presumed explanations for that outsourcing is that these cases require environmental law specialists with scientific experience, expertise, the type of expertise you wouldn't traditionally have in an AG's office. Along with the opioids, anything that's public health and safety, there's often a look for outside counsel. So that's been in pharmaceutical litigation. So states have pursued legal action against drug manufacturers over the opioid crisis. And the argument there was also we needed somebody with more medical knowledge and experience in pharmaceutical regulations and litigation, which is not something an AG's office traditionally does. Product liability cases, sometimes when an AG's office, under the Consumer Protection Authority is going after a product issue, can be outside of the scope of the attorneys that are traditionally work in an AG's office who represent state agencies. Antitrust actions come up a lot. And then also intellectual property cases, there's a lot, because often many state AG's offices don't have in-house attorneys with significant intellectual property experience.
So you're saying that we're seeing this come up with specific sorts of regulatory subjects, and they do tend to be maybe a little bit more technical, a little bit more complex. So there's some rationale to it. But then again, the concern is about bringing in, say, the outside counsel is maybe going to have a different set of incentives and maybe litigate the case differently. One other question on this: is this something that we see at all at the federal level, or is this exclusively a state local phenomenon?
It's interesting that So I worked in the federal government. I, you know, ran all the litigation at the Department of Homeland Security. If this came up, it didn't come up all that often. I'm sure there was some use of outside counsel, but the larger federal agencies tend to have the expertise I think they need in-house. Also, I think there's probably one reason I think you see some of it more at the state nature is the level of the kinds of actions that the state generally can pursue is different than the federal government. So state attorneys general, most of their authority tends to be consumer protection authority, and they have broad authority to remedy what anything that they perceive affects consumers negatively. And so they have a pretty broad authority. And so if they see a wrong as an elected official, a politician, often they have one, a political pressure, you know, in terms of getting elected or reelected to pursue it, but also a genuine interest in if their constituents are upset about something, they're going to be pushed by the constituents and they're going to feel pressured to take action on things. And if they don't have the expertise, they don't have the resources, they're going to need to go to outside counsel. And, you know, employees in the federal government, for the most part, don't have those at least same political pressures or the direct electoral pressures.
That makes sense. And you mentioned that there are laws in some states that restrict the use of outside counsel. What do those look like? Do they tend to be in, say, the regulatory statute itself, you know, specifying that maybe only the agency can bring the enforcement actions, or how do those work? What are we looking at in terms of sort of status quo on this sort of regulation?
Yeah, so there is no one size or one scheme that governs outside counsel as it applies to states, let alone counties and cities. Counties and cities often, because this is coming up more recently, it's even more of the wild, wild west. But in terms of states, given this has been happening for about the last 20 years, there's a few different things that they've tried to put into place. There's been caps. If there's a contingency, a fee agreement, there's been caps on the amount of the ultimate recovery. There's also, I believe, Texas had an action where the agreement with the outside counsel, which I actually thought made a lot of sense, at least in the abstract, was they got either a percentage of the recovery or a multiplier on their hourly fees, and they got the lower of the two amounts. So the state got the benefit of, if it, you know, took longer than the state thought it was going to take, then they were protected that way. Or if it was a quick win, the state was protected because, you know, if it settled in 1 month and the attorneys had put in 100 hours into it and the state got $50 million, the state was going to probably end up paying maybe even $100,000 or less for that ultimate recovery. And the state had the authority to settle that. So that's one thing that you could cap the amount of the contingency. You could have a hybrid where you get the better of, you know, two different options. Other things states have done is require functionally an RFP process that's transparent. So, you know,
what's an RFP? Mind defining that?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, a request for proposal process. So that if I'm the attorney general of the state and I want to hire outside counsel, I can't just hire my friend Luke Wake. I would have to put out a proposal saying the state of blank is looking for outside counsel to litigate this kind of case. We're looking for somebody with this level of expertise. We're looking for someone who has, you know, who can.
So let's basically, say 5 minutes, I'm sorry, shopping around the way you do procurements for other government projects.
Yeah, that's a better way to say it than my rambling, but functionally require that there's some level of process out there that the firm has to meet. They have to meet certain requirements and they have to be able to litigate it. And then it's truly opened up and then outside law firms can submit their bid for it.
Okay. Well, you know, all of that makes sense, but
one other thing I should mention, I guess, One other very common check on this is a legislative approval. So some states, and I think it's in Texas and Florida, they require any significant contracts with outside counsel be approved by the legislature. And so I think the kind of the three main things are fee caps, legislative approval requirements, and then a competitive bidding process through the RFP.
And, you know, of course, the sort of countervailing concern, there's a lot of different, you know, concerns in play when we're talking about how the state is going to wield its executive powers. And I think there's a sort of separation of powers issue lurking here. I'm not really exactly sure. I haven't spent a tremendous amount of time thinking about it, but you do get, you know, it does raise sort of an interesting question as to what extent can the state delegate away its power to enforce the law, which, you know, is an executive power. Most states have a separation of powers that puts that, vests that specifically in an executive branch. To what extent are you raising constitutional issues when you are delegating that? And I don't know if you have thoughts on that. Maybe it depends again on the sort of the extent to which there's actual oversight, but you have thoughts on that?
So I find those arguments appealing, but to date, they've been largely unsuccessful. I don't know that anybody, I shouldn't say that. I'm not aware of any prominent case where a defendant has made that argument and ultimately won. There's been some, I can't remember the case off the top of my head. I think there was a case in California where a defendant made a separation of powers argument, won at the trial court level, was reversed by the California Supreme Court. So to date, those arguments haven't been successful. But I also don't think that doesn't mean those arguments cannot prevail. Each state is different. Each state's constitution is different. Each state's statutory scheme is different. So that doesn't mean that even if in a particular state, the state attorney general has the ability to hire outside counsel, has the power to delegate that, that doesn't mean it's been done correctly or effectively in that particular case, right? So as one example, even if it were appropriate that a state attorney general hired outside counsel to litigate a case for them, if they were to delegate settlement authority to them and you were able to find that they genuinely did that, maybe that's something that you could raise and that a court would be willing to entertain. I think one of the biggest problems, though, is given the lack of transparency between the communication between the state AG's office and the outside counsel they hired, which is going to happen kind of in every case because of the attorney-client privilege issues, it would be hard to know exactly what authority they're delegating and who's truly running the case.
That's a good point. Well, but regardless of whether one frames it as a separation of powers concern or just a matter of sort of good government concerns about transparency, as you've noted, but also, I mean, there's other interests here. There's interest in ensuring, on the one hand, that the state's regulations and so far as they're going to have regulations are enforced justly, but not maybe not in an overly draconian manner either. And you know, to what extent are you inviting, you know, dropping the hammer and coming down harder on people than maybe the state would? Presumably, the state is acting in the public interest, at least presumably. Whereas, again, there's a question mark with private counsel. To some extent, though, that would seem to be alleviated, normatively speaking, anyways, if you have a requirement, anyways, of active oversight, as opposed to just, you know, giving a marquee, a letter of marquee, go out and sue on the high seas. I don't know to what extent, you know, this phenomena resembles the letters of marquee or, you know, but that would seem to be a real problem in my mind if these attorneys are just sort of let loose and go out and bring cases as you like and settlements as you like and so forth.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest problems is that even if that were the case, and let's say you had the scenario where a state attorney general hired a private law firm and let them do that, they're probably not going to admit that because they know that would be problematic in terms of appearances. Let's say that they hired a private law firm and they didn't want them to do that, and the law firm was doing that. There's still an embarrassment factor where you'd have trouble getting them to admit it. So it's hard to get to get insight into what's truly happening. But I agree with you that it's problematic, and, you know, there probably is some level of oversight requirements that could be imposed to counteract that. For example, you may instead of allowing that, you know, only the outside counsel to attend a mediation session or a settlement or whatever, maybe it's that, you know, whether even if you hire outside counsel, someone with authority as from the senior team in the AG's office has to be involved in those discussions, or has to have oversight, or has to, you know, give the ultimate up or down. I don't know exactly how that would play out, but keeping the AG's office involved would, I think, to some extent mitigate that. You know, in these kinds of situations, there's no perfect answer where you would be able to say, hey, if we do this, it would, you know, it would entirely alleviate the problem. But that doesn't mean we don't try to chip away at it.
Sure. Well, you know, I'm just thinking about, again, it's a different context, but bear with me for a second. Other context where you're talking about concerns about maybe private interests wielding some semblance of government power. This comes up in, say, licensing boards, right? Licensing boards are often comprised of private individuals who are engaged in the occupation that they're regulating, and they have they're exercising in some sense ostensible government power as in their role as the licensing board, and yet they have private interests in all of this, and so far as they're in that industry for which they're regulating and keeping out competitors and so forth. And at least in that context, the antitrust laws have been interpreted to say, well, we've got to, you know, look at the NC Dental case. We've got to have active state oversight of those boards, or else there's an antitrust problem. I can see similar sort of logic here as in so far as there's concerns about public whether they're using the public interest or acting in the private interest and so forth.
No, I definitely agree. The NC Dental Board itself had a big impact on the operations of the state attorney general's offices. That case came down just as I was entering the Nevada attorney general's office. And, you know, my first task as general counsel was figure out what this means and figure out how we need to change how we're representing the agencies and the advice we're giving them about what they can do. So I guess it's a great example of, you know, changes do have effects, right? It's not that something happens and it goes out in the ether and it's ignored.
Well, if I understand you correctly, part of the problem is here is that we don't know the extent of the problem, because you're saying there's major transparency issues. So if we were to go out and do public records requests on this, for example, we're probably we're going to be stonewalled, right? I mean, how would you even go about if you wanted to figure out the extent of the problem? I mean, I suppose maybe if you were an elected lawmaker in a given state, maybe you could hold hearings or something. But I mean, how could we even begin to wrap our head around to what extent this really is a problem?
So I think one would be pushing states to have more transparent laws regarding their use of outside counsel, right? So if you had at a minimum an RFP process needed to be followed, then there would be a request for proposal that would be put out, and we would understand what the state said it was looking for. And then if the responses to those needed to be made public, we'd know what the responses were. We'd be able to look at that RFP and scrutinize whether, you know, it had requirements like one of the, I mean, I'm exaggerating here, but you must have an attorney named Luke Wake, right? Was it particularly tailored to a particular law firm, or was it not? Or was it truly a genuine request to find the best counsel to represent the state in that action? So I think step one would be getting the states to be more transparent about this, requiring more disclosure. And a lot of states already have done that. I think there's been a good effort towards that, particularly in Florida, and maybe other states could look to that.
And if I'm understanding you correctly, though, this comes up more with regard to specific regulatory subjects, but you're not saying that it's more problematic with specific regulatory subjects one way or the next. Your concerns are your proposed reforms, if you had a magic pen and could create legislation, wouldn't necessarily center at all on the regulatory, the nature of the subject, it would be sort of more even keeled and apply sort of across the board. Is that right?
I think that's generally right, but I would change that a little bit. I think the problems of hiring outside counsel and the oversight that we'd want and the transparency we'd want would apply to any concern. That said, I think that, you know, there's some things where we have less concern. Off the top of my head, almost no state is going to have attorneys who are proficient in patent prosecution, right? And if only one-off chance that the state had some patents that it needed to file, hiring outside counsel for, you know, not, I'm not saying a nominal amount, but nothing in the tens of millions of dollars to do that is probably not as large a concern, right, as hiring somebody on a contingency basis who's seeking $200 billion.
Yeah. Well, are there other guardrails that you know, normatively speaking, think people should be thinking about here if you're concerned about this as an issue?
So, Luke, I think that's a really good question. I have a few different things, some of which we've already covered. I think, you know, what we want are some guardrails or safeguards to strike that balance between allowing governments access to the necessary legal expertise and resources that they may need and may not have, you know, for the larger cases where they may need bigger staff for a more complicated matter. And, you know, that may not look like how it's done now, but there is a place for the use of outside counsel. And so I think we want to preserve that. But while we ensure there's accountability, transparency, and most importantly, alignment with the public interest, right? And so I think the most important thing is what we talked about before was having transparency requirements. So that's functionally mandating public disclosures, requiring the contracts between government entities and private counsel, especially if it's contingency fee agreements, but probably everything be made publicly available. And, you know, states like Ohio passed laws requiring public disclosure of any contract with outside counsel. And I think Florida has and some other states. But then apart from that, also not just the disclosing the agreement, but probably detailed reporting of the payments and the recoveries. So, you know, governments could require that any payments to private counsel be clearly documented and reported, if even not in publicly available documents, but to oversight bodies. And so there'd be at least one other mechanism, and whether that's a legislative oversight body or somebody else or specifically created entity. I don't have thoughts on off the cuff. You know, and we talked about it before, probably having a true competitive selection process. So having genuine RFPs. The other thing that we've talked about, but I think it's important, is having maybe a limit on contingencies fees. I talked about how Texas had that hybrid where the state got the benefit of whether it was a low hour amount or whether it was a low recovery. Texas paid, you know, the less of the two. And some states have done that. There's also what some states have implemented, and I think is important to consider, is a tiered fee structure. So if you had a contingency fee, it would be a sliding scale. You'd get maybe more of a recovery for the first X million and less as it went up and up and up. And so there wouldn't be this situation where, you know, you would have a private firm that would be willing to litigate the matter because there's a large recovery for a smaller percentage, but we're giving away more. So we're giving away 40% of $200 billion, where no law firm necessarily needs that. The other thing that's similar to transparency, I think, would be, you know, and we touched on it a bit, would be oversight and accountability mechanisms. So finding a way to retain government control over key decisions. And so I think I said this, but I think one of the most important guardrails would be ensuring that those government officials retain ultimate control over key decisions, even when outside counsel is involved. And so that means decisions about whether to settle a case, whether to go to trial or pursue certain forms of relief, right? If it could go either way. If you're sitting there as the private counsel, you may say, well, I don't want to take this risk. I'd rather get the settlement now because I want the money in my pocket. Whereas, you know, in theory, we have public officials who are accountable to the people, who would be making that interest based on what's in the best decision of the people, not what's in the best interest of their own pocketbook. Along with that, we might want some periodic reporting to government authorities, you know, along the way in case. I don't know exactly the nature of the audits that we want, but you might want backward looking audits to make sure that, hey, we entered into this contingency free agreement, or even an hourly agreement, or whatever this agreement is with outside counsel. And how did that work? And those backward looking audits, one, maybe that, maybe we could use the law to have some sort of ability to change the amount of the payment or change what happens based on what the discovery in that audit is. You know, you have a contract that looks forward, allowing you to look backwards. But even if you didn't do that, auditing them after the fact would let you learn about what you want to do going forward. Another thing that we didn't touch on was kind of the conflict of interest rules for government attorneys are different, and not every state has required outside counsel who represent state or local agencies to follow those same conflict of interest rules. And I could be moved off of this, but at a base level, it seems to me a no-brainer that if you're going to come in and represent the state as an attorney, you should have the same ethical obligations and the same conflict of interest rules that a state employee would have. And I think I'm going long here in this answer, but there's a lot here, because this is the meat of it. Is what would we potentially do about it, right? And so I think also legislative or executive approval requirements that you might want to have, require the legislature to sign off. You might, from the executive branch, you might want the governor to sign off, because they can have different interests and or have an executive body the governor creates. So some sort of executive review process. I think some states have already established this. And the last thing is figuring out, you know, certain cases where we want to limit that delegation of authority and say, look, in these kinds of cases, the state, you know, maybe we say, look, in your run-of-the-mill consumer protection case, the state is well capable of doing this. This is their bread and butter. And often they're hiring outside counsel to do these cases because they're high dollar value. And so you have outside counsel coming in and pitching them when the state really could do it themselves, and we could keep all that money in the state. And so, sorry for my rambling, but those are my thoughts on things we could consider.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot of ideas there for anyone who's concerned about this as an issue to pursue some reform. It sounds like there's things that have been done in a number of states to sort of model on. The interesting thing here is how, at least as you've described these issues, they strike me as all issues for which there really ought not be any sort of ideological disagreement. I wouldn't anticipate, I mean, it doesn't strike me as a red state versus blue state issue. I guess my only question, Mark, is, you know, if part of the sort of benefit of, you know, bringing in outside counsel is that there's an efficiency to it, and that efficiency inures to the public and in some sense, you know, at what point are we putting, you know, bureaucratic red tape up to the point that you limit the efficiency, take away that efficiency? I mean, that's sort of maybe a countervailing concern, but because I'm usually hesitant talking about regulation that's, you know, being imposed on the private sector. And my concern in that context is always, well, wait a minute, is this regulatory, you know, is it worth the juice you're squeezing out of this, given that you're burdening, you know, innovation and so forth? I'm not sure I have the same set of concerns when it comes to keeping the government in line, but it's at least worth raising the question.
No, it's a good point, right? That regulatory burden is regulatory burden, whether you impose that burden on the private or the public sector. There are concerns with imposing a regulatory burden. But I think I would say the same thing to some extent that I'd say with imposing regulatory burden on the private sector. There are times when it's appropriate, right? I'm not one of these people that says we should have no laws, no regulations, no burden whatsoever. The point, though, is to be thoughtful about it. And I think start from the presumption of, if there's no problem, there should be no regulation, there should be no burden, right? And move your way down from there to from adopting, start with adopting the least restrictive burdens you can think of. And that's why I think even when I started and we started talking about it, started with transparency. Transparency to me is, particularly for public agencies, public officials, transparency generally is, in my opinion, a minimal burden. That's the, hey, at least the public should know what you're doing. And then we go down. And I think one of the last things I talked about was limitations on the delegation of authority. I do think that should be kind of a last resort, because we, you know, in states, most states, the attorneys generals are accountable or elected and they're accountable directly to the people. But even in the states they're not, they're indirectly accountable. And we want to, I think, err on the side of allowing them to use their judgment to represent the state to the best of its ability. And that's why I didn't give a specific example of where I thought we should limit that ability to delegate authority. But I think it should be at the end of the level of options, something that we could consider.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've covered a lot of ground here already. And this is, I mean, frankly, there's a lot more here than maybe I initially thought when we first began this conversation. But I think we ought to wrap up soon. But I am interested, before we kind of wind things up, I want to give you some opportunity for some closing thoughts. But I have one more question before we go there. I'm interested in if whether you have views on whether and when it's appropriate or inappropriate for states to deputize private individuals to essentially step into the shoes of the state, into the shoes of the attorney general. For example, California has the Private Attorney General Act, which allows, you know, for example, anyone who has any sort of labor code violation, if I miss my meal and rest break, I can go and, you know, bring a lawsuit in the name of the attorney general. But similarly, for example, you know, Pennsylvania, I'm doing a case in Pennsylvania right now against the Environmental Quality Board there and the Department of Environmental Protection. And their statutes basically say, look, if the Department of Environmental Protection initiates a case, well, against someone for violating the Air Pollution Control Act in Pennsylvania, well, then they're handling it. But if they aren't initiating a case, any private individual, anyone can bring a lawsuit to challenge any violation of the statute or regulations promulgated under that statute. To what extent should we, these sort of concerns are, they're not exactly the same, but they seem ancillary, and maybe in my mind, maybe these are even maybe more important, because I know people are being sued every day under those causes of action, maybe where the state wouldn't necessarily want to drop the hammer. In fact, hasn't dropped the hammer in the case of the Pennsylvania DEP case I'm talking about. It's, well, left to the private sector. So you have thoughts?
Yeah, so I would say while there are a lot of differences between the use of outside counsel by state attorneys general and, you know, functionally private attorney general statutes that let anyone bring an action, at a base level, I think we have the same concern. What we have is we're transferring regulatory authority to someone with a financial incentive, right? And so in theory, and I think in practice for the most part, where you have, you know, a state attorney general who's likely elected, they are responsive to the will of the people. Or at least that's the nature of our system, which I'm not ready to give up on yet. So I'm going to presume that to be true. And so what you have from a state attorney general who's enforcing a statute or a regulation is someone who is looking to do so in a manner that benefits the public. When you have a outside counsel who's motivated by either being paid by the hour or being paid on a contingency, their motive shifts towards one that's financial. Similarly, when you authorize anybody to sue for violation of a statute or regulation or whatever, what have you, you're incentivizing them to do so purely for financial reasons, because they're not going to be able to probably get like a consent judgment that stops the practice. They're not going to be able to get other changes. Functionally, they are able to inflict pain, which could have some deterrent effect, or to get money out of it. And so I think it's just problematic.
It is. I mean, the countervailing argument there, of course, is, well, if we want, you know, to really take this, you know, the legislature passes this standard and the legislature thinks it's really important and they want to ensure the very robust enforcement, there's a certain logic to that. I mean, it's going to result in it being, but it's going to result in it being, litigated the heck out of all the time. And you know, there are certainly cottage industries. I'm thinking about a number of issues here in California. You see all those Prop 65 warnings. So if you ever come to California or any product that sold here, and you know, very much where litigation over very minor ADA issues, or there's cottage industry for litigating those issues, maybe, which aren't litigated elsewhere because there's opportunity to you know, bring in a profit as a private attorney. And so there, I think in my mind anyways, that exacerbates the regulatory burden and dangers when you have this sort of open-ended citizen suit provisions. But in any event, maybe that's a little field and we could talk a lot more about, we could do a whole
lot. Yeah, so I'll say one thing on it and I'll try to be succinct for once. I think generally when you incentivize private actors by allowing them to recover attorney's fees or X amount of dollars per violation, what it results in is the over-enforcement of trivial violations and the under-enforcement of more serious systemic issues. And so I think it flips the incentives that we want entirely on their head. And so generally I'm skeptical anytime that's being done, because I think you want someone accountable to the people to be deciding, hey, when is this truly a serious issue and when is it not?
Yeah, that all makes sense to me. Well, do you have any closing thought here? I know we've been talking a while.
No, thank you for having me on and thank you for having this conversation. I think it's an important issue. I think the one thing I will close with, though, is that I want to be clear, and I think we have been, is that I don't think it is per se inappropriate to use outside counsel. We didn't get into all the reasons that it can make sense. But I think there are many, many, many reasons that it can make sense for AG's offices or cities or counties to use outside counsel, particularly in areas where they don't have the expertise to do so, particularly when, you know, it's a smaller matter where you can bring in somebody who has an expertise you don't know to handle it for you and things like that. And so I'm not opposed to the hiring of outside counsel by attorney general's offices in all spaces. I just think we need to, it's come up over the last two decades. There's been some reform in the area and we need to be thinking more critically about what the proper amount of reforms in that area are and what the proper amount of transparency is. And I think Luke, you said on the head, it's not, hey, I don't like this, and so we need to go to the extreme and limit the delegation of authority to do this in so many ways. It's, let's take a look at this issue, look where does we see problems, and start with the least restrictive ways of dealing with it and work our ways backwards.
Right. We've always, and this is a theme in a number of our white papers of the RTP, just we should be regulating with a scalpel instead of a sledgehammer. But you've raised some really interesting points. And I think we maybe if I'd be interested to see if there's folks on the other side of the aisle who think about these issues a little differently, because I'd love to continue the conversation going forward.
Yeah, it'd be great.
Thank you all.
Well, thank you both for sharing your time and expertise with us today. And to our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.